Hello and welcome back to the Ravenclaw Readers. This week we will be discussing Chapter 3, The Letters from No One, in relation to The Odyssey, Book 10. I'm Claire.
I'm Ella.
And I'm Paul. Thanks for having me on the programme.
You're always on the programme.
It's always nice to be here.
You're very welcome. This week we're moving away from biblical tales to take a look at another ancient text. So this time we're concerned with Homer's The Odyssey, that renowned epic poem most likely written in the 8th century BC in ancient Greece. The Odyssey is a large-scale epic containing 24 books, so we will limit ourselves to just one book for the purpose of this analysis. However, rest assured we will be returning to Homer's poem again in this series. Okay, Ella, once again, do you mind giving us a brief summary of the chapter, just so we're all on the same page?
Absolutely. Okay, so the summer is almost over. Harry, who never receives letters of any kind, is amazed one morning to find a letter bearing a mysterious coat of arms addressed specifically to Mr. H. Potter, the cupboard under the stairs, number 4 Privet Drive. Before he can read it, however, Uncle Vernon snatches it from him and prevents Harry from seeing it. The letter so horrifies the Dursleys that they take the really drastic step of moving Harry to a proper bedroom, and yet when the post next arrives, it brings a letter now addressed to Mr. H. Potter, the smallest bedroom. Vernon nails shut the letterbox, but more and more letters continue to arrive through cracks in the windows and the doors and down the chimney. In desperation, Uncle Vernon takes the whole family on a long and wild trip to an isolated shack on a rock in the sea. That night, as a storm rages outside, Harry turns 11 years old, and just as the clock strikes midnight, there is a sudden boom at the door.
Oh, very exciting. I actually can't wait for that, but we're sticking with Chapter 3. This time we will get to Hagrid next week. I'm just going to provide a quick summary of Book 10 of The Odyssey, the one that we're looking at here. So, here we go. The Odyssey centres around the figure of Odysseus and tells of his voyage home after spending a decade fighting in the Trojan War. In Book 10, we hear Odysseus recount his time with King Aeolus, who gifts Odysseus with a bag containing the winds to aid him in his journey home. However, just as Odysseus's home Ithaca is in sight, his crew unwittingly sets him off course once more. They open the bag given to Odysseus by King Aeolus, convinced it is full of treasures, but instead they release the winds which blow them all the way back to Aeolus's shores. Unfortunately, Aeolus now turns Odysseus away, saying, quote, "It's a crime to host a man or speed him on his way when the blessed deathless gods despise him so." So, Odysseus and his men set off without assistance. First, they face the Laestrygonians, man-eating giants who destroy 11 of Odysseus's 12 ships. After this disastrous affair, Odysseus and his remaining crew find the island of Aia, the domain of the sorceress Circe. Circe feeds some of the crew food that has been laced with a potion, quote, "to wipe from their memories any thought of home," and then turns them into pigs, leaving only their minds human. Odysseus, thankfully, escapes this fate. Helped by the god Hermes, Odysseus resists Circe's magic and defeats the sorceress. Circe recognizes that this man must be the famed Odysseus and invites him and his men, now transformed back into humans, to live on her island. After a year, Odysseus sets sail once more, advised by Circe that he must first go to the underworld before he can return home. So, one of the reasons why I chose this text is because it came to my mind because this chapter, The Letters from No One, reminds me of a voyage. In some ways, it's a futile voyage. The literal journey of this chapter involves Uncle Vernon attempting to shake off those pesky wizards who keep sending Harry letters. And I was thinking, could this in some way be interpreted as Vernon attempting to fight against fate of some sort? From his muggle point of view, are those in the magical community akin to gods in a way, moved by their own rules that are incomprehensible to Vernon's own frame of reference? And then, of course, there's Harry. From the first three chapters of this book, the reader has wanted Harry to come home, that is, to enter the magical world. Harry's journey is distinct from Vernon. These letters being blown his way hold information integral to Harry's personal self. But before Harry can discover that self, he must face the hardship of Vernon's expedition and washes up on the shores of an island facing a storm.
I liked what you said about Vernon trying to escape fate.
Yeah, that was my main influence behind choosing this chapter from The Odyssey, because one of the things that hinders Odysseus's journey home is that he is angered some of the gods, particularly, it's not mentioned in this chapter, but he has angered Poseidon, who, as many may know, is the god of the sea, and he is firmly against Odysseus. And in a way, it's probably less significant from Vernon's point of view, because Vernon is not as important as Odysseus. Like, Odysseus is a very important human. Even the gods or the demigods, they all know who this Odysseus is. Vernon does not have that cachet, though. He's just some muggle who's getting in the way of Harry receiving his letter. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Am I bigging up Vernon too much to compare him to Odysseus? Because I feel like Harry is kind of an Odysseus figure too, but in a different way.
So I kind of looked at this chapter through the two different strands that Claire had suggested of journeys and fate, and I thought there were quite a lot of really interesting parallels there. So I guess we could start with Harry compared with Odysseus. And following on from kind of all of the foreshadowing from chapter 2 of the Philosopher's Stone, when we kind of knew that Harry would be returning to the wizarding world. Mm. You could argue in the context of fate, it's because Harry is kind of destined to re-enter the wizarding world. And we see this in chapter 3. So, you know, his first letter can't reach him. No matter, you know, how much Uncle Vernon tries, you know, he tears it up, he burns them, he goes to this isolated island in complete desperation. And yet, Harry's letters still keep coming, and then when they don't get through, Hagrid arrives. So it's kind of, you know, when letters fail, fate puts Hagrid in instead. Mm.
That's it. Yeah, that reminds me of when Odysseus, after the Bag of Winds is let loose, and Odysseus goes back to the king and explains the situation, and the king says, "I can't help you. The gods have turned against you." But then we learn that is not the case at all. Hermes shows up.
Odysseus does have some of the gods on his side. Athena is,
yeah.
She's not mentioned in this chapter, but she is one of Odysseus's great champions. And also Hermes helps him. But Zeus, is Zeus against? I don't think Zeus likes Odysseus.
He's the Scion of Zeus. He's the off branch of Zeus.
The gods just change their allegiances so often. It's hard to keep track of who's, you know, because they can start on one person's side and then completely abandon them in, you know, the next chapter.
Capricious boy King Zeus.
Absolutely.
Well, exactly. And I wonder in some way, is this that chaos of the gods? Because they always do seem to be in chaos as well. And as you say, they are always switching sides. The wizarding world, at least in this chapter, is firmly on the side of Harry. But there does seem to be a chaotic way of showing that. It's strange that they are aware of some of Harry's circumstance. So they have the cupboard under the stairs, and then they have, as you said, the smallest bedroom, which I think is kind of funny because it's like a bit of shade. It's like, okay, fine, we smallest know you gave
bedroom.
Him his bedroom,
yeah.
But it's the smallest one, which is interesting, because in a way that reminds me of the Greek god position, where the Greek gods are superior to humans, but they're not omniscient. Sometimes a god can be away and doesn't know that others are plotting against them or whatever. And do we see that reflected a little bit in the wizarding world, in that they seem to know bits and pieces of Harry's life, where he's located, for example, in the house, but do they not know that he's unaware of his magical abilities? It seems like Harry's being kind of toyed with a little bit from both sides, from the wizarding world, and obviously more apparently and more harmfully from Vernon and the rest of the Dursleys. Am I being too mean to the wizarding world?
I don't know. I think perhaps it would be useful, especially in the context of this chapter, to kind of see the magic and wizards in Harry Potter as being kind of the equivalent of the gods in the Odyssey. Because in a sense, both of them are kind of higher powers that can defeat muggles or, you know, just regular humans like Odysseus.
Or wreak havoc on
yeah.
No, there is like almost like a prankfulness to the letters.
Which is exactly what...
That's a really good word to use, because wizards mm-hmm. are always pranking everyone.
Yeah.
They prank each other. They prank muggles all the time. So it's really funny that that's a word. I feel like Paul often inadvertently uses these words
yeah.
that are really appropriate
to the
story.
But that's kind of just how the gods in the classic myths
yeah,
treat
absolutely.
The humans. And it's, you know, like, you are a higher power and you know you're superior. You are more powerful than just regular humans and muggles. So you can kind of play with that, you know, you can just toy with them. A cat with a mouse.
You're right. There definitely is an element of toying going on here. I mean, first of all, we do get the letter with the smallest bedroom. And that there's no way that they're just sending all these letters, like piles and piles and piles of them. Because, you know, someone at Hogwarts, there's no way that they're just sending these mountains of letters as, oh, well, just in case he didn't get it. Like, they are fully doing it out of a sense of fun and messing with the Dursleys. Absolutely, yeah.
And you know who else has a bit of fun? Is Harry.
Yes.
With his, like,
yes.
I don't know how you pronounce this name. Is it Dudley? No, I'm
teasing
you. Dudley.
Stop. You know.
With the toilet joke where he's mm-hmm. where he flips on him. And the Odyssey is, you know, it's very old. We get this idea of, like, the hero sort of has evolved out of this image of Odysseus. And Odysseus is cunning.
Yeah.
And he's smart. And today's heroes, equally, they always have the rebuttal, the quick thing to say. And Harry Potter shows you this. He exhibits this two or three times in this chapter.
I like what you say there, because Odysseus is very physically strong, and it's part of his character is that, you know, he is a very good fighter. That's true, but he's not the greatest hero, because we all know that the greatest hero is Achilles. That's Achilles. That's his legacy. But Odysseus is very often thought of as the cleverest, and he's very good with language and the way that he is able to speak to people. And a lot of the journeys that he goes through in the Odyssey, they depend on him being able to talk his way out of a situation. And that is very reflective of Harry's character, because Harry, unlike Odysseus, Harry doesn't even have the physicality to stand up to Dudley and his gang who bully him, because he's so small and slight, but he has the wits and he's able to get away from situations like that.
Oh yeah. So, Dudley is going to,
tease Harry about
the school he's going
school,
to.
Yeah.
And Dudley says to Harry, "They stuff people's heads down the toilet first day at Stonewall," he told Harry. "Want to come upstairs and practice?" "No, thanks," said Harry. "The poor toilet's never had anything as horrible as your head down it. It might get sick." Then he ran before Dudley could work out what he'd said.
Yeah, so there, Harry is just using the cleverness of language to confuse Dudley so that Harry himself could then just get out of that situation. And I think that's so funny. I when I reread this, I forgot that Harry is, he has such a cheeky streak to him. You know, he's not, he's treated so badly by the Dursleys, and it's quite sad and terrible, but he's got a liveliness to him that you can't help but admire. Because when I was a kid, I was so shy and just, I wouldn't say anything to anyone. So I had remembered Harry being more like me when he was with the Dursleys. Like, he was really shy and kind of like held back. But then I reread this as an adult. I was like, oh, hang on. No, Harry's like got a mind of his own and he's well capable of looking after himself.
He's also exhibits the most important of heroic qualities. He's got gumption. So yeah. He plans different ways to get the ladder. He goes down and he trips over Sleeping Vernon, or he thinks of intercepting, reading the letter before he brings it to the kitchen, or getting one of them from the hotel they're staying at. He's not passive.
Yeah, he's an active character in his own story, even though he is really limited in what he can do. He still wants to go out there and do something, even though he's only like this 10-year-old kid who has to circumnavigate, like.
And that's a quality of heroes, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Odysseus goes out and kills is it a stag? And feeds all the people, all his crew and things. And it doesn't really pay that much. It doesn't move the plot forward, but it tells you a characteristic of Odysseus and as a type of person he is.
Yeah. So here we're having the groundwork laid for the Harry that nothing comes of his plans in this instance, but we get an insight into what type of character he is. And I had actually underlined that bit where it says he has a plan, and I put a little note beside it saying scheming already, because he always comes up with these plans. I mean, Harry, people kind of make a joke about Harry being really unobservant in the magical world, but I don't think he is. He's always planning. He's always got something in his mind that's like part of who he is. He never wants to sit by and do nothing. He is a man of action, even at 10 years old.
You kind of can't have the destiny as such that Harry has without being able to plan, because, you know, there's no way he could survive if he couldn't plan.
Yeah, I always find it weird using these words like fate and destiny about Harry, because of what we'll get into in later books about the prophecy and all of that. So we're not using that word in those terms of, a completely prophesized in the traditional sense, because we know that prophecy, like the important thing about the prophecy is that it's not actually fated to come to pass. It's what like Voldemort does that makes it happen. So I think when we're using these words, we mean them in a more general sense rather than in a specific Harry Potter the Chosen One type of thing, which is again like a whole other category that we can deal with when we come to it. But yeah,
the character of Harry is always looking forward into the future, either through planning or to his birthday. And Dudley, you can compare that to Dudley, is always looking at the day through the TV show. Harry remarks that you can always know what day of the week it is because Dudley knows the TV schedule. He's thinking much shorter term. He's looking at now while Harry is always looking beyond. And that is a heroic quality equal to gumption.
In the way that Odysseus is always looking forward and trying to get home, although he does get a bit distracted, but still that's his aim, is to get home to his wife and his son. Odysseus has a very stated goal that's very obvious, and Harry doesn't have that yet, but he still wants to move forward. He doesn't want to be stuck where he is.
I've just thought of a really interesting point when you said that, actually, in how you say that at this stage, Harry doesn't really kind of know what's coming. He doesn't really know kind of his plan for the future. And it only just occurred to me then that it's really Dumbledore who kind of sets him on that path by telling him this stuff. So if we do want to look at this chapter kind of through the lens of fate, could Dumbledore be like a fate-like character?
Yeah, I absolutely think that Dumbledore is that type of character. This idea of Dumbledore being this like puppet master who's pulling everyone's strings is a bit of a trope now in a lot of the Harry Potter fandom. And I don't mean to think of Dumbledore as a malicious kind of character in that way, because I think he's actually a very complicated character. But yeah, he absolutely is pushing Harry towards a certain direction. And we'd learn later, I feel like Paul's at a bit of a disadvantage because he doesn't know all this yet, but we do learn later that that is what Dumbledore does from the very beginning. Once Harry steps into Hogwarts, Dumbledore has a plan for him, and he has to kind of mould Harry in a certain way to get him towards that goal.
So I think a distinction between the characters of Harry and Odysseus is Odysseus has an end. He wants to get home, but he lacks the means to do so. He has to look to others for help from the gods. Harry has the means to an end. He has this inherent magical ability. He's cunning, but he lacks the end. He doesn't know, like you said, he doesn't know what's coming. And maybe it's up to that end is defined by Dumbledore, you know?
Yeah, especially when in the next chapter we do find out I can't remember if it's explicitly stated, but it's clearly implied that it's Dumbledore that sends Hagrid to get Harry. So again, that is Dumbledore right there. In the same way that he sent Hagrid to get Harry as a baby, he's now Hagrid's returning to collect Harry at the very end of this chapter again to bring him into the magical world.
Is the next chapter the chapter with the famous line, "You're a wizard, Harry"?
Yeah, but I think in the book it's actually reversed. He says, "Harry, you're a wizard."
Harry, you're a wizard.
Yeah.
Do you think that's like Odysseus seeing
far off in the distance, Ithaca.
Yeah, Odysseus gets so close where he can see his home, but then they get blown off course. And even though Harry doesn't see the magical world because he doesn't know it, he sees his 11th birthday, and he knows that that's important. And there's a really nice line where he's saying, still, you weren't 11 every day. And I just thought that was so sweet, because this is happening in the midst of when Uncle Vernon has lost his mind and he's just driving the Dursleys all over the place. And Harry is still like looking on the bright side of things. And it was really heartfelt, I thought. So he does see something on the horizon in a way that is hopeful,
yeah,
to him.
And I suppose he, you know, to hear that you're a wizard, to him it's an end. He's got out of this miserable life with this miserable life. But really, his journey is really just beginning.
So maybe I feel like the Harry Odysseus parallels work out really well. The parallels and differences, actually. Maybe I was a bit off key when I was suggested that there were, in some strange way, Vernon and Odysseus parallels. Not in that, I'm not sure. Maybe I'm still willing to defend that point, though, because I don't think that Vernon's our hero. Obviously, Odysseus is our hero, and Vernon is not. But he's the one who's being kind of thrown around by fate and by this chaos. And that in a way does mirror Odysseus's situation in a sense. But is the difference between Odysseus and Vernon one of the many differences? Is that, and in a way this is interesting because it harkens back to what we were talking about, Harry and his plans. What is Vernon's plan? He doesn't have a plan. What's he doing? Can anyone reason this?
So basically what Vernon wants to do is just get as far away from home as possible.
That's true.
Completely the opposite of Odysseus, who just wants to get home.
Mm.
But Vernon is just trying to outrun the letters and just trying to fight a greater power that he just can't defeat. Which in a way is kind of similar to Odysseus, I suppose. So
is he trying to outrun the birthday? Does he know something about mm-hmm. the 11th birthday? I mean, in the first episode, we speculated about what Dumbledore said mm-hmm. or what was in that letter.
You think, though? I mean, Petunia always knows more about the wizarding world than she lets on. She tries to hide it, but we actually see she's very knowledgeable. And how could you not be? She must have seen Lily go off to Hogwarts on her 11th birthday.
She absolutely did. It's in Deathly Hallows.
We do, in fact, see it. So I feel like even if Vernon maybe didn't know, Petunia certainly would have done.
Okay, I think it's interesting that you mentioned Petunia, because I want to talk about her, but it's strange because she's actually not really in this chapter a lot. What they're doing is all Vernon's idea. And it's strange. I mean, you don't really get an insight into their relationship in that way, and which is fine. It's not what the book's about. We don't really need much. But there is this strange way where she's very passive. And I don't mean to denigrate Petunia by saying that. I don't even mean it as an insult, but she is being a very passive force. So in a way, I mean, Vernon's the, you know, he's the captain and Dudley and Petunia and then Harry is this tag along. They're just the crew, right? They don't know what's happening. They're being shunted around. And I feel like Petunia, should she say more? Because it seems like she agrees that with Vernon that magic is dangerous and she doesn't want Harry to have magic. So in a way they have that shared goal. But maybe she, as you were saying, Ella, she clearly does have more of an insight into the magical world than we realise and than Harry realises. Harry doesn't realise this until what, Order of the Phoenix or something, just how much Petunia knows. So perhaps she disagrees with Vernon's methods because she knows that they're not going to work, but she still humours him. She's still going along with it. Why is she doing that?
Well, similarly, in the Odyssey, there's that character, I can't pronounce his name, who doesn't go into Cersei's house and refuses to leave the boat, but does eventually follow. What is that character's, what purpose does that character play in that segment of the, in book 10 of the Odyssey? Because he knows the magic that goes on in Cersei's house, and he sees it as a trap.
I've always thought that it was Eurylochus.
Eurylochus sounds right.
Because I always hear that like Telemachus.
Yeah.
And I was, so I think of the parallels.
Yes.
Does that character exist just to reinforce Odysseus's resolve? To show that he believes that he will be helped, or the gods will help him overcome Circe?
Oh, maybe it is just a kind of a dramatic device to emphasize Odysseus. Perhaps the reason why Petunia is so passive in the Harry Potter chapter is because she kind of needs to be, because this chapter is really the struggle between Harry and Vernon. Mm-hmm. And so if Petunia being any more active in this situation would almost kind of detract from that.
Does she know that they can't outrun it?
I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think in a way Vernon probably knows as well. Oh, this is actually scary, though, to be honest. This is where I was going to save this question till later, but maybe it's useful to bring it up now. In the Odyssey, one of the things that we see in Book 10 is that Circe's magic is actually really dangerous. And the only way that Odysseus can get around it is by help from Hermes, who's a god. So he needs the help of the gods to get around this magic. So in a way, is Vernon right to be scared? I'm obviously completely not on Vernon's side, and the way he's going about it is absolutely wrong and scary, and I think he's actually putting his family in a lot more danger by doing this. But just from that emotional standpoint, is it understandable why Vernon would think that magic is dangerous?
Well, I think he has just cause to think magic's dangerous, because of course somebody like Harry, who is fundamentally a good person, would never abuse his magic in that way. But we see it countless times throughout the book, particularly with the Death Eaters and the way they just go around torturing muggles and, you know, just being using their magic for really evil purposes.
Yeah.
Harry's parents being murdered.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they are using it because they can, because they have this higher power which the muggles don't have. And like the gods, they can just play with them if they want to.
And it is kind of scary thinking about being just followed by this force that you have no understanding of. I don't know.
That could be quite a nice segue into talking about Circe and magic as it's represented in the Odyssey.
Yeah.
Because as Claire has rightly said, Circe's magic really is quite dangerous, and she's really powerful. I mean, we see she's obviously skilled at transfiguration because she turns men into pigs.
Yeah,
she's good at potions because she whips up all of these potions that, you know, to wipe the men's memories. Mm-hmm.
She's got Snape and McGonagall attributes. That's a pretty lethal.
That is a lethal
combination, to be honest. Like that is scary. So
Odysseus as a human, if we compare him to a muggle, by himself he has no way to overcome Circe's magic because it is more powerful than him. But of course we see Hermes, he's a god, but we could maybe say he's like a magical figure to bring in the Harry Potter comparisons. Mm-hmm. He is the one who kind of intervenes, and he gives Odysseus this kind of antidote almost to Circe's magic, which basically renders Circe powerless and puts them on a more equal playing field. And what I think is then really interesting is that we then see Circe as a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. And she then has to kind of turn to seducing Odysseus in, you know, the traditional, use your womanly wiles that has been something we've seen throughout time.
It's like Terminator.
Interesting, right?
So it's like Terminator 1. You have Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's the worst. You poop your pants when you see him. And then in the second one, Sarah Connor is given the power, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger to, you know, that. But then another Terminator comes who's way worse than the Terminator that Arnold Schwarzenegger is.
Yes, where is this going?
We like seeing the normal people be given this power, mm-hmm. which we feared up to that point. So the first film, this was the symbol of terror, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and in the second one he's on the good guy side, and you think you're invincible, but there's always a higher power out there. Nothing will relieve you of that struggle, be it your struggle home or your struggle to read a letter or your struggle to prevent the future robot apocalypse?
In a way, the Terminator story is similar to the Cersei story in that the Cersei's magic is terrifying. The detail of the pigs being the crew being turned into pigs, but then still having the human mind, that's the scariest part. That's a terrifying idea.
And what does Cersei tell Odysseus that he has to do afterwards? He has to go to Hades. Mm-hmm. So can you imagine anything more terrifying? I mean, his crew ripped the hair out of their heads in terror at this idea. What's going on there?
I think there's so much to be said about Hades and the underworld that we might just save for other chapters, because that's a whole chapter in itself. But you're right in that she signals the going to the underworld, mainly because there is this very important idea in a lot of ancient myth, and I think it resurfaces in Harry Potter very clearly, a few symbolically, but then also very evidently in the last book. You have to go to the underworld and come back alive, and that's what symbolizes you as a great hero.
Harry's biggest fear at this point is the Dudley gang.
That's about to change.
Yes, it is.
I feel like I'm really kind of stretching the bounds of credulity here with some of my points.
I just talked about Terminator.
In the I love, like, parallels is probably one of my favourite words, as you might have determined from how many times I've said it in this podcast. But I was looking at other kind of parallels between characters and them being fate themselves. And I've already mentioned Dumbledore, and I thought maybe we could see Cersei as fate as well. Because, as we've just said, the chapter finishes with her telling him that he has to go down to the underworld. She's the one who's directing his path. And also, it's her choice, essentially, to kind of free Odysseus almost. I mean, she kept him on this island for a year, and now she's like, no, it's okay, you can carry on with your journey now, I let you go, and you now have to go to the underworld. So she's kind of holding the power in a way that kind of the fates do.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Like, it's a power that you don't notice until you something happens where you kind of become aware of it. It sounds a weird thing about to say that it's a passive power, but you wouldn't actually think about, because you think, oh, well, Cersei is being defeated by Odysseus, and in a way she has, but she still, as you've mentioned, she still does have a kind of power that you wouldn't have thought of as a power until you realize that it's at her word that Odysseus can leave, mm-hmm. and at her instruction. So there is actually still something there that she has, and that she is using to her advantage.
Oh, just sort of thinking out loud, Odysseus overcomes some great trial, but it still taxes him, and then it commands him to move on. Can we see that in this with the letters? I mean, they're running away from the letters, and eventually it's the letters which stops them running away and move somewhere else. I don't know if there's something there.
I think that, maybe, funnily enough, the thing that we have kept talking about for the last three chapters is this idea of coming home or being banished, and I didn't notice that this was such a recurring theme in these early chapters before Harry knows about the wizarding world. But one of the things that is evident over and over again is that the Dursleys' house is not his home. So in that way, Harry has to journey and find his own. And one of the things that I noticed, interestingly enough, about Cersei's island, Aya, the thing that Odysseus and his men notice that there's a civilization there because they see smoke rising, and they say, oh, well, that means that there's someone here. And we know that the idea of fire and warmth and a hearth, that's a very homely image. And one of the things that Harry notices when they make it onto the island is that the fireplace is completely empty and Vernon can't start a fire. And I thought that was an interesting to look at that symbolically, as that this place, not just the location, but also these people, this is not where his home is. This isn't where he belongs. There's no fire. There's no warmth there for him.
There's no hearth, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, it's such a symbol of home, isn't it? Even from pagan times until now, where they used to have a fire in their home burning for their ancestors. And the biggest taboo was for it to burn, to go out. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what a symbol of, like, being away from where you're supposed to be, where you can't even start a fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, talking of fire, kind of the centrality of fire, you know, it's the fire and the armchairs around it is the focal point of the Gryffindor common room,
yes,
where Harry has always felt so at home. So again, it's that kind of, you know, this continuing metaphor.
It's such an image.
Home is where the hearth is.
But it shows you how these, the symbol, has emerged like organically,
yeah,
out of cultures,
yeah,
and writers like J.K. Rowling are using this without even realizing what, you know, where it's come from, what it means, but it's something we all recognize as being symbolic of home. So I read a different translation, and the
translation that Ella and I both read was the Robert Fagles translation, who actually does a very good translation of the Odyssey, the Iliad, and the Aeneid. So I would highly recommend it. But yeah, Paul read a different translation, which is interesting because it had a different chapter name, right? A different name of book 10.
It emphasized the wind aspect of it. So the bag of winds that he receives.
Yeah, I've heard that before, actually. Whereas this emphasizes the Circe aspect. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about use of wind as a symbol of inspiration. So you have that symbol with the bag full of the wind that you can use to get where you need to go. But you will also conversely have this image of a storm, which is chaotic wind. Mm-hmm. And sort of bringing that image into this chapter of Harry Potter, you have Vernon. He's trying to keep Harry on the course, the straight and narrow, the no magic course, the regular normal life. Mm-hmm. And at the end, what, you know, it's this image of them in this house and in a storm. It's almost like symbolic of them being unable to, you know, outrun their fate.
It's good that you mentioned that, because I wanted to bring up the storm at the end. I almost was thinking about this was actually to parallel this chapter with maybe one of the Brontes, maybe a Charlotte Bronte novel, because they have a lot of storms in their novels. But it still completely ties to what you were saying, because when the Brontes, especially in Villette, if anyone's read that one, what a storm symbolizes is change. Like, it's the moment of change. It's that chaos when everything in the world is in a whirlwind, and we know something big is happening. And that is exactly, obviously, what happens here. It's the exact same thing. It's the moment of transformation and of change. And it is chaotic and it's scary. But for Harry, it ends up being something useful and hopeful at the end of it.
Harry, you're a wizard.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, I just had completely going... My train of thoughts have just caught up now with the fire discussion that we were having.
Yes, go on.
And it suddenly just occurred to me that one of the very first things Hagrid does when he arrives is set the fire,
yeah,
going.
Yeah, he does.
You know, because he's like, Hagrid is kind of home for Harry. You know, he's,
yeah,
part of Harry's family, the family that Harry makes in the magical world.
Even chapter one,
mm-hmm, yeah,
he's the image of, he's the father figure.
He is.
Like, you know, he wants to say goodbye to the child.
You know, he's introducing this homely touch.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's very important. One of the things that I wanted to talk about, and it's completely not what we were talking about at all. The reason why I mention this now is because if I don't talk about it now, I don't think we'll get another chance. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Dudley. I can't really parallel it to anything in the Odyssey. I just wanted to talk a bit about his characterization from this chapter and maybe the previous chapter that we've seen. His role in the family is because I remember being a kid and reading this and thinking that Dudley was terrible, and he is, and he's just awful. But, and I know that the Dursleys get called out on this later on in Half-Blood Prince, and Dumbledore calls them out. But these, Petunia and Vernon, are just not raising this boy to be... How did they expect someone good to come out of the way that they're raising him? They have a whole room in this house just dedicated to his broken things. Even at the beginning of the chapter, it says that, you know, most of the stuff that Dudley did, his birthday presents, are already broken. This is less than like a month since his birthday, and he's already broken a bunch of his stuff. And it's this real carelessness at the way that he treats his things. And I think that that's just indicative of I feel kind of mean saying this about like a child, but just a bad character. You're not going to build that person into a good human being. And I think that Vernon and Petunia do actually love Dudley and they do care about him. That's clear, but they're just going about it completely the wrong way.
You know, I suppose it shows you that you can have everything in life and still not know or lead a good life. But with Harry, he doesn't have anything. He's lost his parents, but he builds something. He takes, you know, and it's about taking responsibility for your cine camera or your TV. And through these obligations, which you choose or don't choose, that's how a good life is sort of built. And Dudley is given every opportunity for that. And he fails. And Harry is, you know, isn't. Everything is taken from him. And eventually he does succeed.
Really interesting about Dudley, though. It's a bit like with Snape. He gets his moment of redemption right at the very end in the final book.
Yeah. I actually have a lot to talk about that because I feel like that is built up very well. Dudley is not a lost cause. And I like that. But I think from what we're seeing here is that he could be. Like, this is clearly a child who's never heard no. We saw it in the previous chapter when he was getting throwing tantrums over the idea that Harry had to come with them to the zoo. And when suddenly Dudley and Harry are being kicked out of the kitchen because Vernon and Petunia want to talk about the letter and they don't want Dudley to hear. And Dudley doesn't, it's like he doesn't even comprehend what's happening because, I mean, obviously there is a bit of the kid curiosity of like, oh, what are the grown-ups talking about? But he doesn't understand that why his parents are saying no to him and kicking him out of his second bedroom. Like, all these things are just so offensive to him. He's never experienced this before.
So Dudley, I've just thought of something. Dudley covets all these items and things, but so does Harry. I mean, so he goes to Mrs. Fig's house and he's like, oh, he gets to watch TV. In the previous chapter, he just wants to stay home so he can watch TV and play his own video games. When he gets to the bedroom, the smallest bedroom in the house, he said, up to yesterday, this is all he ever wanted. But now he wants more. There's, you know, so he also is coveting things.
Yeah, but Harry appreciates what he gets. He doesn't appreciate the second bedroom, granted, but that's because he knows that there's a bigger mystery there. But he appreciates staying at Mrs. Fig's and being allowed to watch TV. And Dudley doesn't appreciate these things. They're all broken. They're all discarded. They're all just crammed into this little room. Whereas the thing that Harry covets is this letter. And it because it holds great significance to him. And it means more to him than the bedroom does because it's a personal thing for him. Like, he doesn't know this, but he obviously suspects, and we as the readers know, this holds the key to Harry's person. His identity is in that letter, and that's what Harry is after.
So in this text, we have the Harry is moving from primary school to secondary school. And in primary school, I don't know what it's like in England, but in Ireland, you learn, in mathematics, you learn about prime numbers and Venn diagrams. And then you move to secondary school and you don't hear a single thing about them. It's like they never existed. And you're like, well, they weren't. That's like kid stuff. And then I went to university and I did physics. And all of a sudden, you're reintroduced to number theory. And all of a sudden, you realize, like, modern computers, like cryptography is all about factoring primes. So much, like, some, it's a serious grown-up mathematics is about this stuff that you learned in primary school and didn't even think about in secondary school. And similarly, when you're young, you look at a book or a movie or whatever, and you might think you're told to think of symbols and themes, and you're like, well, you know, and then you grow up, and you're like, that's just like kid stuff, and you're supposed to think about the, you know, deconstruct the text, and this is a blah, 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 whatever. And I find myself getting older that I'm looking more and more for these themes or symbols. And I feel like I didn't, like a child not knowing the potential of, like, you know, the prime numbers and number theory, I didn't understand, you know, what the teacher meant when they're saying what are these symbols and themes. And I think that's part of what this podcast is to not only point out those symbols and themes, but try to understand where they came from. And we, you know, that we, you know, talking about the heart, that is like perfect, because you know, it's pointing it out and explaining where it came from, and it takes on this different significance, and it's like, it's something we share, and that people 100 years ago they settled around a fire, and 200 years ago and 300 years ago, and it's a way of sort of staying in contact with a tradition or with our ancestors. And that's why we can read a book like the Odyssey written by Homer and still get so much out of it. And it's, you know, it's still relevant today because it's informed so much of, as we said in this podcast, the idea of hero and these symbols and fate. And it's great. And I like this podcast. The end. So that was my story. I just started thinking about it because of that transition,
yeah.
of that Harry's doing in the mm-hmm. thing. So there you go.
Thank you so much for that, Paul. That was really lovely. Join us again next week when we will be looking at chapter 4, The Keeper of the Keys, in relation to the poem by John McCrae, In Flanders Field, which is actually a poem written in 1915 during the First World War. So we'll see you then. Thank you so much for listening.